Hello there, this is Doc Brown, and I want to explain the problems with the sound that you're about to hear. My microphone burned out literally on the day that Ben and I interviewed. But the content was so good and the interaction was of such high quality that we decided to bring in a sound engineer to clean it up. It still sounds like we're in a fishbowl, but just understand that the mic burned out. I'm actually talking through a mic that is not burned out. So that said, enjoy this extremely important interview regarding bond investing.
Welcome to the Master Your Money podcast from drscottbrown.com. Get inside the thinking of investment masters of stocks, bonds, derivatives, retirement, and taxation.
Ben Eiler is a bond trader and First Southern Securities partner. Ben embodies more than 15 years of industry experience specializing in providing fixed income solutions to individuals, financial advisors, and fee-based money managers. When asked of Ben, Eric Shahinian of CAMAC Partners says, "My firm has invested in municipal bonds with Ben at First Southern since I believe 2013. We invested in many of the municipal bonds they mentioned and found each of them to be quite mispriced and cheap. Even the ones I passed on for various reasons, they ended up being right. I find that their knowledge of the space is top-notch. They have a great work ethic. They're scrappy and do the due diligence. They're also operating in an area of the market that they are well above the competition in my mind. Since 2014, we've invested in their Forces Fund. We were the day one investor, and I plan to keep our investment there for a very long time. It's been a positive experience. Performance has been good. And more importantly, they've made money for the right reasons. Their thesis being correct. I need say no more. The University of Puerto Rico School of Business Student Alumni Association is proud to present bond trader Ben Eiler. I know you come from a small town, Ben, played college football, married your grammar school sweetheart, but how did you end up a ninja assassin in municipal bonds? How did you get started?
A friend of mine referred me to a bond firm in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I got an interview there. I went, interviewed, and at the end of the interview, I thought the guy hated me. I thought he couldn't stand me. So I proceeded to call him every day for 3 weeks straight and leave voicemails and email him and just wear him out. And eventually, I just showed up unannounced.
Yeah.
Went into their office, and the lady asked me, the receptionist said, "Do you have an appointment?" I said, "Nope, but tell him I'm not leaving until he sees me." So he made me wait about 2.5 hours, and finally, he opens his office door, kind of yelled at me very angrily to come inside there, and he told me that I was very persistent, and if I'm that persistent, he'd give me a chance. So that's how I started, 1998.
The typical reason one of my students seeks me out for help is regarding bonds. On multiple occasions, I've had younger heirs reach out to me to help with bond portfolios of convalesced or deceased family members. In these cases, a large bond portfolio was involved. As time passes, these portfolios disgorge cash, and younger family members have no idea what to do. Could you outline the various solutions that families have when a large bond portfolio falls on somebody's lap?
Sure. I think it depends on the individual age and circumstances of each individual family. If they're younger folks, then I encourage them to take a little more risk and buy some high yield, which, as you know, that's what I love. That's what I get excited about. And obviously, the older they are, the more we pare down the risk and the time horizons for their investments. If they're younger, we'll take a little stress to duration out a little longer while building a ladder or whatever their strategy is. And if they're older, then we'll keep that duration shorter.
Mm-hmm. Right. Under what circumstances do duration and coupon targets make sense for retail bond investors?
Duration targets make sense for hedging interest rate risk. Coupon targets to me don't make a lot of sense. I don't really care what the coupon is. I'm more interested in my total return on my money I have invested. I think an investor should look at total return or current yield if they're invested for income. I don't really pay attention to coupons.
Does anybody pay attention to coupons out there? Is that a problem?
Yeah, some people do, but I think they're uninformed.
Yeah.
But yeah, they do. Mm-hmm.
I know you're really big on high coupon. Under what environment should duration and coupon be disregarded?
First off, comes to mind is a distressed situation. Something's in default, it doesn't matter what the coupon is. If it's going to be restructured, and then they begin to trade on dollar price, and you can take a coupon maturity and all that and throw them out the window. That's the only circumstance I can think of.
Is there a difference in your mind as to how younger versus older investors should think regarding the bond portfolios? You already alluded to that, but could you give more detail?
Sure. I think young folks should absolutely be more aggressive with their portfolios. I think they should certainly look at high yield situations. We mentioned earlier, like the default rate, even among high yield world, is like, 10%. So yeah. not terrible risk.
No. Never.
And I think they should pay attention. Now, you need to find a good broker. You don't just go out there and randomly get on a website and start buying stuff, because that's where they unload the bad bonds. So you need to find a good broker, which that's not the easiest thing in the world to do, to help you navigate that world.
So this is kind of a quick question that comes off of what you just said, talking about unloading bad bonds. Could you give examples of that and how that process works when they unload bad bonds on bond investors who don't know what the heck they're doing?
Yeah, I got to be careful what I say. Sure, I can give you some examples, but typically what they do is there's these different trading platforms out there that everybody's really big on right now, because they believe that you save the commission, which isn't really true, because if we're taking down bonds, we're taking risks, and we put them on the platform, we're going to make money. We're not doing it for free. So the commission is still built in there. But when you have bad bonds, obviously you don't want your clients to have them, and then you want to get rid of them, some way, shape, or form. Typically, that's the platforms. You're going to throw them out there, and you're going to let, sell them through the platform so they don't come back to your own clients, I guess.
So it sounds to me like what happens is that basically you've got this inventory you don't like, and you want to get rid of it, so you go throw it on one of the platforms, and then I'm guessing, because I don't know this process that well, that the platform charges an additional fee that you would otherwise not charge a fee, and because of that, the unknowing investor ends up buying a bad bonds at a higher price because they're also paying that additional amount on the platform. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
No more said. Okay.
Yeah. Just be careful on platforms. That's what I was saying. Be careful.
Let's talk about accredited investing in bonds. Now, accredited investing, for our listeners who don't know what the heck that is when you have a person that's high net worth, high income, combination of both, one or the other, then they're allowed to have access to deals that the public who are lower income, lower net worth, cannot have access to. And that's through something called Regulation D, right, which in 1932 and 1933 was created as an option for the large brokerages to be able to offer deals straight to their high net worth, high income clients. Today, that's developed to an industry that's very opaque because people are not allowed to market directly on TV and so forth to accredited investors. So it takes these kinds of conversations to discuss how that kind of dark pool, it's not really a dark pool, but in a sense it kind of works like that, that people don't know what's going inside of it. And what I'm asking is, if you've got an investor who's a very high net worth, high income person, do they have different return expectations when they're putting their money into something like the Forces Fund, which can only be accessed by an accredited investor, for instance? Do these people think differently than the people that you have in the public who are not accredited investors? You work with both, Ben. So is there a difference in mentality between the two groups? There's not necessarily a difference in intelligence, but there's certainly a difference in experience. There's a difference in the amount of money that's being thrown around and stuff. And how does that impact the thinking of the accredited investor versus the non-accredited investor?
To contact Ben Eiler for custom financial solutions for investment professionals and individual investors from First Southern Securities, go to fssec.com. Ben's Forces Fund focuses on distressed debt, primarily in the municipal market. It is for accredited investors only. The fund started in December 2014 and has had great success, returning 18.63% net of fees and expenses in 2016, and is up 6.72% through April 2017. Go to fssec.com for more information right now.
I don't really think there's a lot of real difference in thinking. And you alluded earlier that it's not like you're more intelligent because you're a credit investor versus not. It just simply means you have made more money or inherited more money or something of that nature. I don't think there's a lot of difference. I don't even think your return expectations could be a whole lot more, because very few bonds out there, the percentage is very small, that are Reg D private placements. So an unaccredited investor has a lot of opportunities, a lot of things they can invest in. And they should find plenty, because if they're unaccredited, obviously they probably don't have a ton of money to invest anyway. Mm-hmm. So I don't think this should make any difference in their return expectations.
You know, You know, over time, I've almost decided that unless you have a background in finance, being labeled as an accredited investor is almost a disability as an investor because you get stuff thrown at you that you shouldn't be looking at.
I agree with that. I agree with that statement.
But bonds is very different than stocks. Search costs are higher, and there are barriers of buying direct for the small retail investor. Could you explain the difficulties a retail investor would face trying to repeat the kind of credit speculation you do in the municipal bond market?
Sure. The high-yield world is a small world, and there are very, very few brokers and traders that are really very good at it. And if you're not informed, you're going to be the guy on the platform that ends up buying the bad bonds, and you're going to lose money. You know, if you want to buy high-yield individual bonds, you're going to have to find a good broker. And you can call us, First Southern. We'll take care of you. I got guys that can help you.
Investment advisory industry, to be an odd beast. These are people who charge fees but do not buy and sell for their clients, unlike money managers such as yourself. It's far more expensive to attempt to buy bonds in this manner since the fees for the recommended advised transaction must yet be paid after the advisor's advice. Say that three times fast. Hence, I'm against such investment advisory services as overpriced. Could you comment on the Richardsons?
Sure. The investment advisor is a broad word. In my mind, there are two types. There's asset managers. Asset gatherers, and then there are money managers. And asset gatherers are guys that are good at playing golf, and they're good at making friends, and they're good at, you know, getting along with people, so people put their money with them. They don't necessarily know how to invest money, but they know how to gather assets. And then behind that, you've got money managers, and these are people that actually, you know, do know how to invest money, do know how to pick individual investments. So I think it's a broad word. If you get a good money manager that knows what they're doing, I think they're worth their fee. I think they earn their fee. But as far as just an asset gatherer, he's going to put you in funds or ETFs, cross his fingers and hope for the best. I think that's a waste of money.
You have a remarkable yield in your speculative fund that was in the high double digits. Could you tell us about that and give us some detail on how you're able to extract that out of bonds of all things, which is a real surprise to probably a lot of people on this call.
Sure. Yeah, our fund is called Forces Opportunity One. Everybody asks me what Forces is. One of my partners is a Greek. And anyway, it's a Greek god. It's the ancient sea god of hidden dangers of the deep. And that was his idea. It is a fund that focuses on distressed debt, primarily the municipal bond market. Like you alluded earlier, it is for accredited investors only. So we started in December 14. We've had some great success. Last year, we were up over 18.5% net of fees and expenses. We're up at this point over 7% this year. And so how we do it is we do a lot of homework. We're very informed with what we're buying. And I guess our strategy is knowing what we're invested in and buying at the right price. So if we go out and we're looking for a bond, most everything we have has some sort of a first mortgage, some sort of real asset behind it. Not 100%, but 95% of the time we're going to have that. So if we're trying to invest, say, in a multifamily housing project that's got HUD projects, got municipal bonds, and it's in default. If we think that thing at a fire sale is worth $10 million, then we're trying to buy those bonds, you know, for 50, 60 cents on a dollar of that $2 million value.
Right.
So that's how we do it.
Awesome. Fantastic. I happen to be a fixed income researcher in finance. One of the questions we're trying to answer through the data is to what degree executives include covenants in bond intentionally. One argument is that the boilerplate is so common that covenants are rarely thought through to any significant degree in the contracting process. The counter-argument regarding covenants is that the CEOs intentionally include covenants to give them financial flexibility for contingent events down the road, such as acquisitions and mergers. What is your experience regarding contracting and covenants?
I'm not sure how intentional they are. You see these mostly in corporate bonds versus municipal bonds. The thing is, no one reads official statements. I mean, 300 pages of lawyer mumbo-jumbo, and nobody wants to read through it. I think the key is to be informed with what you're buying. And in order to do that, you got to read the official statement, which takes time. After a while, though, after almost 20 years, you get to the point where you know what's important and what's not, so you can read it pretty fast.
To contact Ben Eiler for custom financial solutions for investment professionals and individual investors from First Southern Securities, go to fssec.com. Ben's Forces Fund focuses on distressed debt, primarily in the municipal market. It is for accredited investors only. The fund started in December 2014 and has had great success, returning 18.63% net of fees and expenses in 2016 and is up 6.72% through April of 2017. Go to fssec.com for more information right now.
So it sounds to me, reading between the lines of what I'm hearing, is that the politician who is dealing with the municipal bond issue is probably less likely to care about the covenants, and certainly not going to read the boilerplate, whereas the corporate manager is more likely to be aware of all the covenants in the contract, at least through his legal advisors, because it has such a large impact on the functioning of the corporation. One of the things that we're seeing right now, for instance, with the Detroit collapse and the Orange County debacle, and now the bankruptcy of Puerto Rico, is that there's an enormous problem in terms of agency problems, in particular with municipal series, that researchers in finance have not really acknowledged until, I'm not even sure they're still acknowledging how immense the agency problems are in municipal issues because of politics. Whereas in a corporation, I would expect that perhaps the CEO might be a little bit more hard-nosed with in terms of what covenants are being added to a bond series. Would you agree with that or not have anything that you could add to that? Or
no, I agree. I mean, typically a CEO of a major corporation issuing, you know, $500 million worth of bonds, they're usually pretty informed. They've got a great staff of legal advisors. Whereas a municipality, especially a smaller municipality, you know, you've got less money to work with. Therefore, you typically don't have the same quality of legal counsel, you know. And I would agree with that. I think they're definitely on the ball versus some of the smaller municipalities as far as what to put in, what not to put in. But you as the investor still have to read through and make sure you know what you're buying. And that's the key.
Yeah. You know, Ben, of anybody that I've ever talked to on bonds, I learned more from you. And one of the things that really got me thinking, I mean, fantasizing about it, was you talked about, for instance, some situations that you've seen where you've walked into a state and there's a local branch office somewhere remote in the state that is inhabited with...
Here's where the rubber hits the road so that you can start to think and grow rich. Go to drscottbrown.com right now to get an online stock investment training worth $200 for free entitled, How an Illiterate 18-Year-Old Minimum Wage McDonald's Cook Becomes a Millionaire in 50 Years.